Hello and welcome to the Seattle Retro Gaming Podcast. My name is Nathan Martin, and I am the co-founder of the Seattle Retro Gaming Expo, and I'm here with...
I am Kinsey Burke, and I'm the PR manager for Seattle Retro.
And we also have a special guest with us here today. Introduce yourself, please, special guest.
Sure. I'm special guest Robbie Zinchek, the creator of 8-Bit MMO.
All right. Thank you for joining us, Robbie. We first found out about your game, the 8-Bit MMO, at SakuraCon 2014, where we had a booth. And you were kind enough to take some time out of your busy schedule to sit down and talk a little bit about your MMO and some of the games you've been playing. And we'll talk a little bit about Seattle Retro Gaming Expo as well and how that relates to indie developers. So I think we should just jump right in. Let's talk a little bit about what we've been playing. So special guest Robbie Zinchak, would you like to go first?
Sure. So I've been playing in my free time. I've been playing a game called, I just discovered this on Reddit, so you know it's going to be awesome. I just was playing a game called Factorio, which I just backed their campaign, and it's pretty sweet. It's it reminds me a lot. I don't know if you guys ever played Free Enterprise back in the day. It was a game about like managing factories and stuff. So this is that in like a sci-fi setting. So
awesome.
They basically got you like they have you crash land on this planet, and I guess instead of like trying to escape the planet, instead you're like, let's build this awesome factory on this planet. Which doesn't make a lot of sense narrative-wise, but in gameplay is awesome because you're creating this huge system of like, you know, you over here you've got stuff being like mined out, and over here you've got like the stuff being smelted into like intermediate ingredients, and you've got this huge network of stuff, and then the aliens don't like you building factories, so they like do like a Zerg rush at you all the time. Aliens are always trying to destroy my factories.
Sounds cool. So it's like a kind of like a single player StarCrafty resource management type experience?
Yeah, it's got a little bit of that. I feel like the aesthetic that it really reminds me of. I don't know. Maybe it's just because of the way it's rendered, but it seems like it's got like a lot of 3D rendered sprites into 2D, or at least has that effect. So it reminds me a little bit of like the visual style of Command and Conquer Red Alert, if you remember that from back.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Nice.
Right on.
Yeah.
That's cool. And what's that on? Is that PC?
PC. So I think they're actually on all the PC platforms right now. So Windows, Mac, Linux.
Right on. Yeah. Are you typically a kind of a strategy guy?
I am all over the place. So I love everything from like the strategy games to like platformers and everything in between.
Cool. Great. That sounds really cool. I wish I had more time to play PC games. I've been particularly busy this last month and a half, so I haven't had a chance to play much of anything. But on the last podcast, I mentioned that I watched some videos from Legend of Zelda Spirit Tracks.
Mm-hmm.
And then this weekend, at a garage sale, I just happened to pick up a copy of the Legend of Zelda Spirit Tracks.
Nice.
So I just started playing that. And it seems pretty interesting so far. I mean, it's touch-based, and I didn't really know that there was a Zelda game like this, but it's one of those games where you lead Link around on the screen, on the touch screen with your stylus, and you tap to do rolls and stuff like that. You don't use the D-pad at all for movement. So I'm curious to see how that's going to play out. It seems like a match made in heaven when you kind of think about it, but I don't know exactly how well it's going to work for this game yet.
I played through Phantom Hourglass, which has the same like movement structure, I guess.
Okay.
And I didn't like it. But I know a lot of people really enjoyed that. I just was like, my hand's in the way all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But was that was the one where you could get, like, you get the dungeon maps and you can write notes on the dungeon
maps?
So that
was
pretty cool.
Yeah, I like that. It's really weird seeing the dungeon map on the top screen and seeing all the action on the bottom screen. Like, I'm not used to that.
Mm.
And the first time I started playing it, I kept trying to move Link, and I was like, why does the map keep moving onto my screen? Like, but I'm looking forward to it. It looks like it's going to be fun. So we'll see. How about you, Kinsey? What have you been playing?
I've been playing two things.
Ooh.
I just found out, because I'm a loser, that the third episode of The Wolf Among Us had come out a while ago.
Oh, yeah.
I'm usually pretty good about this stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, I play it day one.
Mm-hmm.
Well, unless you have the season pass and for episode two. Whatever. It was a... Yeah. You know if you saw it. But so, I played episode three in one sitting, and it was wonderful.
So what do you think of the series as a whole so far? Is it...
It always leaves me wanting more, but that's kind of Telltale's thing. You know, mm-hmm. They give you like a 2-hour episode and they're like, see you in a couple months. So they always seem short, but I always enjoy it. Like, cool. The story's really good. The art style's beautiful in The Wolf Among Us. So I absolutely love it.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to what their Borderlands game is going to look like.
Yeah,
like,
and they're doing a Game of Thrones one, too.
Ooh.
That's,
yeah.
I am a huge Game of Thrones fan.
Yes. Are you up to date? Are you all caught up
on with the TV. I haven't read the books yet because I don't want to spoil the TV series.
Yeah.
I don't know if that makes sense.
I do audiobooks, so those books are kind... There's a lot of people in those books. A lot of characters. So the audiobooks are maybe not the best way to do it.
Although if you get the audiobooks and you like combine that with the Vantan Hourglass note system, you can figure out like flow charts of characters.
Oh man, that sounds like a car accident waiting to happen. The whole reason I do the audiobooks is because I can do it while I'm driving or while I'm working or whatever. So
yeah,
that's maybe not so much for me, but but I do. I'm with you. I really enjoy the show and I'm mm-hmm. looking forward to it. I watch it with somebody who is a huge Game of Thrones book fan. And up until the last couple episodes, she's always been like, oh, you're going to love today. You know what's happening now. And I guess now it's starting to deviate pretty heavily from the books. And so she's just as lost as I am. And I love
it. Nice.
I'm kind of the worst nerd ever. And I've read half the first book, never seen any of the TV show.
Really?
Oh, the TV I know. One day. Sorry. One day. I'll do it. It's bound to happen.
Right. Well, it's great to marathon it, too. Like, watching him one week at a time is kind of painful. Because you're just like, oh, I want to see what happens next.
And there are only 10 episodes a season, and it's like a year and a half between seasons. Yeah. It's brutal.
I'll get to it. Mm-hmm. I really will, because I love, like, medieval mm-hmm. stuff.
When you're ready, let me know. I have the first season on DVD.
You know how many times you've told me that? And I'm like, yeah, give it here. And you're like, I have... 2 weeks later, I have that first season. Did you know that? I'm like, yeah, I did know that.
All right, remind me. I'll give it to you when I play Mass Effect. So, I was going to do this if Rob was going to be able to make it today. Unfortunately, Rob couldn't make it, but I wanted to catch up on our resolutions for this year.
I have the Uncharted series by my PS3.
Yeah. So
what's May now? So
that's okay. I'm supposed to play through the Mass Effect series, and I haven't even picked them up yet. So you're still a step ahead of me.
I really will, though. I will.
Yeah.
They haunt me.
I think my resolution for this year was to not make any resolutions, and so far I'm doing pretty good on that.
All right. Yeah.
I'm kind of jealous of your resolution.
So what are I was. Thinking about this idea, Robbie, it started out with thinking about game reviewers,
mm-hmm.
and the idea was that there's no, like, with movies, there's kind of like this taxonomy of movies. Like, these are kind of the movies, if you want to be a critic of movies, you have to watch these movies. So I'm surprised that there isn't something like that for games, and maybe there is, and I just haven't found it yet. But is there, give me one game that you would consider kind of your definitive game? Something that would help define
that if you are on the path to being a professional game reviewer, you play more than one game before you start reviewing games.
All right, well, just give me one example. I'm picturing a whole library, but...
I think that you really need to do a spursing, so you should go back to the roots. You should play, you know, classic Mario, Zelda, like kind of the classic console games. Mm-hmm. You should play some of the classic PC games, too. You know, go back, play some Zork. Play all that. You got to do the modern stuff. So especially games that kind of helped define genres. Like I feel like first person shooters like Halo really helped kind of define that genre. But if you look before that, there was a whole bunch of other games. You know, Doom even way back when. So mm-hmm. I feel like you need to play a fair number of a whole library of stuff. Kind of not just within the genre that you're reviewing, but since there's a lot of crossover between genres in the industry, mm-hmm. you know, all the genres.
Okay. Yeah, I kind of think of it as, like, we spend too much time reviewing the game in terms of, like, well, this game, you know, the graphics were good or, like, the controls are okay. But I'm interested in, like, what makes a game fun and how do you define that? And genres are really hard to define in that regard. Like, Grand Theft Auto is not a racing game, but there's cars in it. There's racing mechanics in it. Mm-hmm. And you can demerit the game based on that. But I don't know that you would necessarily say it's a bad game because you can't control it as well as in... Gran Turismo.
Sure.
So that's kind of what I've been struggling with. I've been debating whether or not I should start an article about or a series of articles kind of covering what games. But what are some of the older, like the NES or Super Nintendo games that you would consider classics that need to be played?
Oh, well, definitely, you know, I would think, you know, classic Mario, like especially probably Mario 1 as well as Super Mario for SNES. Obviously, Metroid and Castlevania in particular, because that kind of helped define that kind of open world gameplay, which, you know, I don't think I'd seen a whole lot of before that point. You know, if you're looking at, you probably need to get some quality Tetris time in. You know, it's, man, there's just, I think there's a lot that you need to kind of go through.
Okay. Kinsey, do you have any ideas, any thoughts on that? On what you want to?
People should pretty much just play RPGs. That's kind of where the business is at, so.
You know, I like RPGs because they still evolve. They're evolving a lot. I feel like platformers, maybe you know, we're playing around with the medium of platformers, but we're not innovating. But like Bravely Default innovated on the turn-based RPG convention.
Yeah.
You know, by really changing how you use your turns. Turning turns into a commodity is an interesting concept to me.
Hmm.
So, yeah, I agree with you there. For me, I love Bionic Commando. That is one of my... Mm. I think that's just a study in excellent gameplay mechanics. Like, I would... There are only a few games that I've played where I'm like, I wish I could build the tool or use the tools to build the worlds to play around in. You know, like Super Mario Brothers is kind of like that. Like, I just wish there were more levels. Mm. I don't need new tropes. I don't need new items or powers or anything. I just want to be able to... I just want more levels of Super Mario World.
Mm.
You know, and I want more levels of Bionic Commando.
I was playing Retro City Rampage the other day.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the bosses, I guess. Mm-hmm. I don't know if he's harder. Was he a boss? I don't know. But he had the Bionic Commando hook and swing.
Oh, really?
And I almost died because I was like, oh, that's so cool. Oh, he's killing me. Like,
I really like Retro City Rampage. I was playing around with that the other day. And I like how, you know, Brian is the guy who developed that. I like how he basically took that kind of retro aesthetic and then he's put stuff like a cover system in there.
Yeah.
And you would never, like, if you were playing it, you know, 20 years ago, you, like, that the whole cover mechanic hadn't even come around yet. You know, it's just cool to see kind of that mashup.
It's pretty awesome. I'm not super far in it,
mm-hmm.
but I like that you can also change the way the graphics look. You can change it back to, like, old, like, Commodore graphics.
Mm.
And it's, well,
oh, really?
Commodore colors. You can, for the graphics, you can only do, like, 8-bit or, like, Retro Plus,
mm-hmm.
which is like 8-bit with shadows. And I'm playing it 8-bit.
Great.
Cool. So, and
is it something you can toggle, like, whenever you want?
I don't know.
You can,
maybe.
You can turn it on or, turn it on and off at will.
I probably. I mean, it's just in the options, like, before you go to resume game or whatever, mm-hmm. like, right there. So I'm assuming you can.
I was super excited about Evo Land when I found out about that game. It's like it's a Legend of Zelda style action, you know, adventure RPG, but it starts out in this 2D world that's black and white, like Game Boy colors, kind mm-hmm. of that pea green and lime green color, and then as you go on, you unlock new kind of achievements or treasures, and one of them is the ability to move up and down. And
oh, I played this game,
and it changes. Yeah. It changes.
This
from
is a flash game, right?
No, it's a Steam, it's a greenlit game.
Oh, cool.
But yeah, and then, you know, eventually you get to the 8-bit RPG, and then you mm-hmm. get to the 16-bit RPG, and then the full 3D, and, the thing about that game is it starts out with the lower end graphics and mechanics, and then it eventually, you're always playing in the high end stuff. But I always thought it would be cool if you could, like, different dungeons had different, you know, different layers or different levels to them. So that Retro City Rampage sounds like it has that, a little bit of that in there.
It's pretty awesome. There's been a lot of games that I've been playing actually lately that are, I don't know, they're not graphically what people think is amazing. They're not quite there. I've been playing Thomas Was Alone.
Mm-hmm.
I'm literally blocks, you know. Mm-hmm. But I have a weird attachment to some of these blocks. Laura, I feel for you. Like,
well, that's cool.
It's pretty awesome. Yeah. I really enjoy it. It's kind of a puzzle platformer and...
Yeah. And they've got a great narrative, too. So there's the narrator who's just going through, and he's really gets you, you know, feeling for each of the characters, and their abilities tie in with kind of what their backstory is for each of the characters.
Yeah.
And I like the fact that they don't emote at all. Even as squares, they don't bounce, they don't really do anything except when you control them, and mm-hmm. you still manage to get this attachment to the characters.
Yeah, like, Chris is just the orange square. And I'm like, well, he's kind of a Debbie Downer.
He is, though.
Yeah, but then he meets Laura.
Yeah.
And then he falls in love with Laura.
Oh,
spoilers. So. But, you know, the square and the rectangle can have love, and it was pretty awesome.
Yeah, that's a really good game. It's a short game, too. Like, a lot of indie games that come out these days are, you know, 2, 3 hours, 4 hours. Mm-hmm. So we've been kind of dancing around your game, 8-bit MMO. We talked a little bit about kind of that taking that old aesthetic and investing new life or new mechanics that weren't previously possible in there, which is something you do with 8-bit MMO. We've talked about kind of going back to your roots and start, you know, kind of having those conventions, which you also do in your game.
Mm-hmm.
And we've also talked about the fact that it's in India and it's on Steam, it's on Greenlight.
Correct, right? Yeah. It's gone through the Greenlight process. It's on Steam Early Access now, as well as Kongregate, Amazon, and our own website, 8bitmmo.net.
Okay. Yeah. Well, do you want to give us the kind of elevator pitch for 8bitmmo?
Yeah, so what 8bitmmo is, it's a construction sandbox game where you can build anything you like in a massive, persistent universe. Mm-hmm. Basically, think like Minecraft, how it's kind of got that Lego block-based building system, meets World of Warcraft. Huge streaming universe with player versus player combat, player versus environment combat, questing, leveling, dungeons, arenas, all sorts of cool stuff to see, do, and build.
Cool. Yeah, and we sat down and played it a little bit before we started recording. It's a lot of fun. It's really easy to just pick up and play, but there's this very complex kind of back-end system of not only being able to build spontaneously, but mm-hmm. to do it in a live shared environment on a server. So you've got the trappings of a massively multiplayer game. We've got people running around and coexisting with your character.
Mm-hmm.
And that's definitely a new idea or a new concept that's pushed into kind of an old 2D space that people are comfortable with and familiar.
Yeah.
What is that like? So you are the main developer? You're the only developer?
That's correct. So I've been pretty much most of the development team for its history. I was fortunate enough to have an intern who worked part-time with me for a little bit, for a couple months. But other than that, like pretty much all of the code, art, writing, biz dev, marketing, like all that stuff is all me. Now, fortunately, I have an awesome community behind this game. So, you know, the players are super engaged, and there's a team of kind of volunteer moderators who kind of help me, you know, run the game day to day. So if it wasn't for those guys, you know, it'd be really hard.
Okay. Robbie, can you give me a little kind of background on what you've done, where you came from in the gaming industry?
So I've been in the industry for about 7, 8 years, something like that at this point. When I graduated college, I went to Midway down in Austin, Texas. I was on the development side there as an assistant producer. And kind of managed some strike teams working on specific areas of a larger title. Then I went over to Capcom and got to experience the publishing side, and kind of got to work with some great external developers on some really top tier projects. Then went over to Microsoft and got to work on some more projects on kind of a publishing side as a producer over there. And then I decided I wanted to go indie, and I'd been playing around with indie stuff in my free time for a long, long time. But I just decided it was kind of the time to go full-time in it. You know, it was no time like the present to just kind of to jump into it. So I think within, I put my 2 weeks' notice in, and then I had, on one particular weekend, I had left the job, the house. I was, you know, basically couch surfing at that point, you know, is but just going like full-time indie, you know, it's because when you go indie, you want to kind of optimize your budget, and so you just want to shrink down your expenses as far as possible. And since I went indie like 3 years ago, I've only run out of money once, and now that that's happened, I'm kind of fearless at this point. So because it's one of the things that I ran out, but I was able to do some great contract work for a certain company in the local area. And I just had a great experience working with those guys and was able to kind of stock up the bank account and, you know, do indie full-time again. So now here I am, the second run-through, and having a lot of fun with it.
Great. Have you been working on 8-bit MMO the entire time that you've been working as an indie, or do you have other projects?
Yeah, so I've been working on the 8-bit MMO, so for the basically the full time that I was full-time indie. In my past, when I was part-time indie, I had some other projects, indie projects that I was working on as well. But, you know, on a one-man dev team, it's definitely good to kind of focus on one project. And it takes a long time to get there. But, you know, you can eventually get there. It's pretty cool. You just got to make smart decisions and kind of scope correctly, which I know sounds hilarious because we're talking about an MMO. But, you know, even within that, there's a lot of smart decisions you can make.
There's a lot of tools in there for users to generate their own content, which I'm sure takes a lot of the pressure off you narratively.
Yeah, so it's very much that. It's much of my kind of design work is on the system side in terms of, like, you know, I don't, you know, I couldn't hold a candle to what some of the top tier players are making in the game because they're just these master builders. And, you know, I'm, you know, I go in, I make a couple blocks, I'm like, yeah, it's pretty cool. And I see what they make, and I'm like, wow, that's amazing.
So let's take a step back really quick. You mentioned that you worked as an assistant producer and producer at mm-hmm. Midway and Microsoft. Mm-hmm. I know the producer roles are kind of nebulous in the industry. Can you mm-hmm. kind of describe some of your duties and roles there?
Yeah. So, I mean, you're very correct. A producer role is going to be, you know, different at every company, and possibly, you know, each producer is going to have, you know, their own kind of job definition. But essentially what a producer does on an internal side is, you know, kind of managing the development process in terms of, like, scheduling and what have you, you know, making sure that kind of that communication link is between kind of line-level resources as well as kind of the upper management of the studio. In an external role as a publishing side producer, you're basically kind of watching the investment of the publisher. So, you know, publisher is putting, you know, X dollars into a project and another development studio, you're the person who's watching and kind of helping the actual development team make sure that they're kind of making the most of that investment and able to kind of hit their goals and milestones, kind of working together with the development partner to kind of be that that person who's looking at the product and making sure it's going to really resonate with customers. What I really like about being an indie is now it's a little bit of both. Kind of the creative side of being a producer as well as kind of the technical side of, like, actually getting content into the game and actually being able to have a vision that you want to implement, having your own kind of vision that you're chasing and then kind of following it through to something that people can actually play.
Yeah, I would imagine that as the team shrinks, the scope of your duties grows until mm-hmm. it's all encompassing. how do you manage to balance the kind of creative from the business and administrative and divide your time up?
Yeah, so generally what I do is kind of when I get into the office in the morning is I typically spend, you know, basically between 30 minutes to an hour just doing kind of community interfacing. So that's everything from going on the forums and answering kind of forum inquiries. That's talking to moderator staff. That's being active on Twitter and Facebook. That's answering support tickets. You know, kind of all the stuff that's kind of integral with that. And then what I like to do is I like to focus on development. So one thing I've found is that if I'm constantly switching between kind of the chat in the game and code, you know, I'm not quite as productive as I can be if I'm just, you know, solely focused on code. And so what I typically do is I divide my time in the day, and I have some dedicated time to interface with community and some dedicated time to get some development done, and typically works pretty good.
Okay.
Yeah.
What do you use for your community management?
So in terms of, you know, technically I'm using some forum software, Envision boards is what I use for the forums. We have this thing called the suggestion box, which I love. It's like this, it's kind of like a forum, except what it is you basically post an idea, and then everyone can kind of, so a user posts an idea, other users can come in, if they like it, they can upvote it, you know, give a little thumbs up to it. They can also comment and, you know, kind of have a discussion on each idea. And for me, it makes it easy. I can go in, I can see, you know, what are the hot ideas at the moment, see what people are really excited and passionate about. And so that's pretty cool. We've got real-time chat, too. There's the real-time chat in the game. There's also real-time chat through IRC, which is, you know, that classic internet relay chat that existed in the 90s. We're still using that today, and it's still awesome.
Awesome. Great. And then one of the things that I've been kind of curious about is, so you mentioned the producer role, mm-hmm. Which sounds very close to a project management role in other professions or in other industries. That's not super development focused. I mean, did you start out as a programmer or did you teach yourself?
Yeah, so I actually went to, when I was in college, I was going through, I majored in computer science and I minored in business. And so that kind of gave me a little bit of focus on both of those. And a lot of, you know, typically having that kind of engineering background, a lot of the assignments that I had on the project management side were more technical in nature. So if there was a project that was particularly technical, like we had this really advanced, I was working on this one project, Flock, way back in the day when I was at Capcom. It was it's a really cool title, but one of the kind of unique things of many features that were unique about that game was a map sharing system. And so because it kind of had this really integrated map experience, it was kind of a good... good project for me to tackle, if that makes sense.
Okay, yeah, so it kind of taught you a lot about what goes into building a larger project or exactly. a larger product like that.
Yeah.
All right. And a lot, I'm guessing a lot of that really helped you with the networking side of the 8-bit MMO.
Yeah. It's the networking side has definitely been fun. It's been one of those... definitely the first couple implementations were not quite there, but I was able to kind of iterate and eventually get the networking where it's really just stable and rock solid now. Initially there was, I think the first iteration of the game could support up to like 6 concurrent players, which was not as many as I wanted. So I was able to go back and do a lot of optimization and, you know, profiling and all that good stuff. And it's a lot higher now.
Cool. All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break, and then when we come back, I've got a few more questions for you about the 8-bit MMO, mm-hmm. and then we'll talk a little bit more about how people can find out about it and support you.
Cool.
All right. One moment. And we're back. We just took a quick break here, and we're going to get right back into talking to Robbie Zinchak in just a moment. But I wanted to mention that there are a lot of indie developers in the Seattle area, and so a lot of them will be showing at the Seattle Retro Gaming Expo. Our indie game section has greatly expanded this year from years past, so tickets are still available. It's possible to pre-register through our website, seattleretro.org. And if you pre-register, you get in an hour early.
Got to get all those deals.
Yeah, if you're a collector, that's a huge deal. It really matters to get in there before everybody else so you can find all the stuff. So, Robbie, let's jump right back in. And I wanted to ask you a little bit about the actual development of the 8-bit MMO. What are you? What's your platform? What are you working in?
Yeah, so in terms of technically, I'm using... as you might imagine, the architecture is pretty intense. It's got a variety of languages involved. So on the client side, what you're actually playing on is Java. Whether you're using that through Java Applet or you're using the embedded JRE that ships with the desktop and Steam editions, that's Java that you're using. Mm-hmm. On the server side, we're using C++ for kind of the server itself. On the game server side, we're also using all the website stuff is PHP. We've switched. We were using Apache, which was pretty good, but we're now using Nginx for actually pushing those pages across the line. We're using for a database. We're using MySQL. We're using libprotobuf for the serialization, deserialization. And is that it? Oh, we're using the Google Maps API for the map system, which is pretty sweet.
Okay.
It looked really awesome.
Thanks.
Yeah, I like being able to look around in the world using the Google Maps API. It makes it a lot of fun to kind of see what you're doing in there.
Yeah, and that's actually new coming up is that what's available right now as of the time we're talking is the old map, which was last rendered in November of last year. There's been so many changes and so much new stuff, and we've got this new system up and running that's got all of the world in. So before it was just kind of a subset, but we're going to have the entire world up and rendering on the new map once that goes live. I'm hoping that'll be this coming week, but might be, you know, who knows in the future. But once that process finishes up, then you'll be able to see it. And the map, just to give you a scale of what you're going to be seeing and why it's using like a Google Maps API, is the size of the map is now sufficiently big that the in-game world is actually larger in terms of landmass than the entirety of the United Kingdom. It's just so huge.
And that's if a square is like 6 foot by 6 foot or
assuming that one tile is approximately 3 foot by 3 foot. So I assume like a door is, you know, about 3 feet. So kind of eyeball it.
Wow, that is huge. Yeah. And all of the content that you see in there, except for the original, the kind of startup tutorial space, is all user-generated content?
Correct. So basically that kind of starting area, the root area, that's me, and then everything else is player-made. So the players are building the world and just making all sorts of cool stuff. It's I'm consistently amazed by just how awesome the community is.
Wow. Yeah, you showed us the map, and there's one guy in particular who's just got a huge space, and it's... And it's not just big, but it's also like very carefully choreographed and laid out and done really well. What does that take in terms of player resources? What do you have to do to kind of build something large like that?
Yeah, so in terms of player resources, there are multiple ways you can approach it. What most players do is they go through and they go in the combat systems. So whether that's player versus environment combat or player versus player combat, they go in, they kind of, earn that gold kind of organically. You can also go through if you, it is a free-to-play game, so you never have to put any money in. In fact, most players, they have a great time just playing for free. But if you want to support development and get access to some, fancy top hats and, purchase some, fancy land in the game, that's that sort of thing, you can support the game by purchasing a platinum pack. Now, even if you don't want to purchase anything, you can still get access to all the platinum items. You just trade a player who's purchased that. And there's a very vibrant economy in the game, so that's something that I see a lot of.
Great. From a design perspective, did you spend a lot of time kind of balancing the economy, or have you focused on that much yet?
Yeah, it's something that every time I make a change, I have to think very carefully about how the economy is going to be impacted. Yeah. One fun thing that happened maybe 2 months ago is we had a new weapon was coming on game. It was a new tile, and it was a trap. So basically what it is a laser block. And you put that laser block down, and if a player comes near it, it's kind of like a thwomp from Mario. So if you cross that line, you get hit by the laser. Now you can get close to it and then let it go and then go past it. So you can. There's some timing involved. Mm-hmm. But one thing that when I released earlier than I intended to, because I had one particular update and I accidentally updated the shop so people could buy it. It didn't have the functionality yet, but it just had the tile for it. So that one tile, because it was only available for 10 minutes until people pointed it out, but that was enough for about, 15 of these things to get sold or whatever. And they were being sold at, whatever the price was at the time, but the player base, the people who managed to get a hold of those items, they then turned around, and since it was only available for 10 minutes... There was such a huge markup. They were selling it at 100 times what they paid for it. It was just great to see, like, it's just this organic economic thing, and it's, like, things that I don't even intend. Like, it's great to see, it's larger than just me. It's this entire network of, connections and what have you at play. It's cool.
Great, yeah. That is really cool. I like the fact that the user-generated content is just there. It just exists. You don't have to sign up or be behind a certain paywall or something. It's available to everybody. One thing that really impressed me about looking at the map was just like the fact that there's just bare land out there for people to kind of claim and use as their own space. Mm-hmm. As we were walking around in the world, we came across a large, clearly planned out and organized area that you could walk around and then... off to the side, outside of that area, there was a six-block house that somebody had put together and put a piece of food in.
Which you ate.
Yes,
you
which
ate I ate. He's going to starve now.
Might have been their only food, and you ate it.
I know. I feel terrible, and I'm never going to play that character again either. I'm gonna start my own.
I think the character's name was, like, Test 1003 or something like that.
Like, so, Test, I'll find you.
Oh, Test 1003. I will get my vengeance.
So, speaking of vengeance, players can generate their own quest content, too, right?
Yeah.
How does that work? Is that something that you set up in the store that people can buy and then they Do they generate income through that, or how does that work?
Yeah, so basically the way it works is that a player can get a reward block. And that reward block they can place at, let's say they build a dungeon, and at the end of the dungeon is the reward block. So it's kind of this thing as a player who might be interested in like trying some new quests, you can go through and the player who creates the reward block can set the title of the reward block and set some quest text. So let's say that I'm some other player, and I'm en route. And so I talk to one of the NPCs called Sir Zombie Brains. And after you get through the first starting quests, he will give you player quests. And so you can talk to him, and he'll be like, oh, here's a player quest from so-and-so. And it'll be your text that he says, in his own, dialogue. And that can be, let's say the text is, journey to such and such a place, and go and complete the dungeon, and then find the reward block. And so you go through, and there's a teleporter that takes you to the same town that the reward block is in, but it doesn't take you directly to the reward block. So you get kind of in the vicinity. Mm-hmm. Then you have to adventure through the dungeon. Or maybe it's sometimes I see puzzles, some sort of maze that players have to get through or some other challenge. I've seen, like, water parks that people have built.
Oh, like, that's awesome.
They've got to, like, get through the water, and you can't actually swim in the game. So you're basically, it's kind of like this trap. I implemented water, but they never said I had to implement swimming. So, but yeah, you go through and you get to the end. You get the reward block. Once you hit that reward block, your name is added to all the players who've gone through and solved it. So it's kind of like a high score list. You can see kind of all the other players who have survived that challenge.
Mm-hmm. And is the game instanced to allow that, or can multiple people be running in a particular quest?
So instancing right now is just limited to... Instancing is a fairly new feature within the past couple months. As such, it's limited to just a few areas. So the tutorial area and root are two instance areas. Mm-hmm. Originally, it was not. Root was all the players at the same time. And so, like, the tutorial, for instance, we had at one point 200 players in the tutorial room. And if you've seen the World War Z movie where the zombies are climbing on each other's heads... That was happening in the tutorial room. Like, all the players were standing on each other's heads in this wall of people and climbing on each other and escaping the tutorial zone. It was... Oh, man.
Okay, so it's only an instance there, but the rest of the world is pretty much open and ready for people to interact with. That's great. Mm-hmm. okay, that sounds really good. I think that was everything that I was kind of curious about with the development in the game itself. I also wanted to ask you about kind of the real-world implications of being your own indie developer. So we're talking to you now in the offices of Reactor in downtown Seattle. It's a very nice environment. There's clearly some proper funding going on here. How does that relate to what you do here, and how did you get into Reactor?
Yeah, so Reactor is an awesome program. Basically, kind of what they do is they take kind of local startups in the area in the gaming and the app space, mm-hmm. And they kind of help them take their projects to the next level. And so I got involved with them. I was at the I won the Seattle Independent Game Competition a couple years back. Mm-hmm. Well, I guess not the one this year, but the one before that. So pretty recently, really. Mm-hmm. And then they got in touch with me about their incubator program that they've got here. And so I applied to that and I got in, and it's been a really great experience, because basically what they do is they take classes of teams, and you kind of get in a class of different teams who are kind of going through this, and you're all kind of working on your projects together. So, you might be working on totally different stuff as the person sitting next to you. But just having kind of those people who are going through similar challenges of like, oh, I need to, solve my visibility problems in the marketplace, or, whatever challenges that you're doing, maybe it's technical challenges, but other people who can provide kind of insight and wisdom. Plus there's, mentorship opportunities. So I got connected with some fantastic mentors within the Seattle space who really helped me kind of, especially when we were getting ready for doing the Steam launch, and we had a big influx of users, so I needed to do kind of some load testing and load balancing and like all that good stuff. And I got some great advice from actually Patrick Wyatt, who is formerly from ArenaNet, And he was able to provide some kind of like, oh, you should think about this, and have you considered this? And that really kind of helped us stay, you know, for doing this big launch. We were able to be successful and not go down in the middle of it, which was great.
Great, yeah. That's awesome. And so since then, they gave you office space, and you've had an opportunity to kind of work. And I know that there are some other startup companies here. In particular, VRcade is here. I know, happen to know Jamie, who was part of the team that started that, and they've got a space set up here. So this is something that they ask you. It's like they invite you in, and, and you're a part of it.
Yeah. So it's they've got an application process. So you know, anyone's available to kind of go in and apply. It's right now they're kind of in between classes, so they're on a bit of hiatus at the moment. But they're looking at kind of the next phase, and so when that comes online, I think that'll be really exciting.
What's the exchange there? I mean, they give you the space and the mentoring stuff. Are they doing it just as sort of like in an angel investor style capacity, where they're just like giving you the resources so that you can use them?
Yeah, so they're actually pretty awesome because a lot of, you know, pretty much all the other startup incubators are like, okay, come on into our space and give us your right arm and, you know, 90% of your company. And, but Reactor's awesome. They're funded through the state, and so that allows them to kind of help the overall industry improve, because their goal isn't necessarily, you know, okay, we want to get these they want to get the companies kind of up to the next level, but it's not so that they can get some like investment share or something out of it. It's it's so that they can create new jobs in Seattle and Redmond and kind of the area, because as you have companies that kind of grow, they're going to hire people, and so it makes sense for the government to kind of encourage that through, you know, targeted growth of this industry.
That's cool. That's very smart.
That's really awesome.
Yeah.
All right. Let's see. What else did we have on here? So, Robbie, I think we've covered anything. Is there anything about the game that is coming up that you are planning or getting ready to talk about? Or
yeah, so the next big thing is going to be the map thing. That's going to be really exciting because we'll be able to see kind of all the new stuff that's come online in the last 5 or 6 months. After that, I'm kind of I'm thinking about kind of the next big thing. I don't know exactly you know, what the next steps are going to be, but I have some ideas that I'm not necessarily ready to announce because I think people would flip out, and it would be like I don't want people getting too excited yet until I've had a chance to design it. But basically what I'm doing this week is I'm sitting down and I'm going to sketch out some kind of big plans for whatever the next big thing is. So the last big sprint that we had was basically on the combat side. So I added a whole bunch of new weapons and kind of bolstered up that sort of gameplay. And so for the next step, I have a very specific idea of something I want to do, and I will say it's something that has been hotly requested by the players, and I'm just figuring out what the best approach to that is, and it might be something that's a big departure from stuff that we've messed with before. It might be something that we approach in a very unique way. So I know that's very hand-wavy, very vague, but I'm very excited.
It sounds exciting. I mean, considering what you've done with the game, just as a one-man team, is very impressive. So
nice.
I'm sure whatever you've got up your sleeve is going to be pretty cool. All right. I think that's about it. Is there anything else that we forgot to cover? I think we're good.
I don't think so.
Okay, great. Let's go one last time. I'll give you a chance to kind of cover where people can find the game and how they can support you.
Sure. So check it out at 8bitmmo.net. You can also check it out on Steam. It's on Steam Early Access, available there. You can also play it on Kongregate or Amazon.
Okay, great. And where can people find you on Twitter?
Twitter account is very hard to guess, but it's at 8bitmmo.
8bitmmo, no yep. Spaces or dashes?
No
or
spaces,
like
no dashes, just 8bitmmo. Same on Facebook.
All right, perfect.
Yeah.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Robbie Sinchak, special guest, for coming out. And
thanks so much for having me. It's been a blast.
Yeah. All right, and we will talk to you guys next time. When's let's see, the show's coming up in a month and a half, right?
Yep.
June 28th. Oh, my
it
God.
It sure is. It's coming up.
Oh,
it's
that's
going to be
scary.
A good time.
You can find us, of course, at seattleretro.org, on Twitter at Seattle Retro.
Facebook.com/SeattleRetro.
Yep. And we will see you guys next time.
Thanks.
Thank you.